To get us started, let's go look at the quiz. I added some comments to some of the questions, so that you can have some of this to look at afterwards, but let's just talk a little bit about it. Pipelining, just worth noting that it, as we mentioned, it takes a single instruction longer to complete. It increases the latency of the processor. And it also means that the processor is doing more things at once. And that combination of doing each one for longer time, but more of them at once, means we get more of them done per second. And therefore, a long sequence of instructions takes less time to compute. We mostly understood B, not so good on A and C. The very purpose of prediction is to make speculative execution go faster. And we'll talk some more about that today. As we dive more into how that works. We had our set of questions about our three-stage processor. So in this first one, as we're thinking about what is in what state, remember that the older instructions are farther along in the pipe, and the newer instructions later. So if we have instructions 1 through 40 and 20 is currently in execute, that means right back in 19, issue 21. We had some people say nothing. That could have been the case if we had stalled, but we explicitly say there are no jumps or dependencies, so there is no stalling that needs to occur. And so this is what the situation we would be in. We had a lot of trouble with the forwarding. Well, I guess there's two main opinions here. So as worded, there were two ways of seeing this. You could see this, we talked about when they are needed. So we said a value is produced at the end of execute and needed at the beginning of execute. And so depending on whether you thought this was happening on the right before the cycle that starts executing or at the beginning of the cycle that starts executing, either E or H could work. Moving the values either from the input or output of R3. That distinction was made more clearly in question 5 here. And I have sort of this little write-up of what was going on. Remember here, we were looking at particular registers and seeing a lot of RAX destinations. We know that, so if we imagine these are three instructions, the one in issue, the one in execute, and the one write back. The one in issue, we know is writing to RAX because that's put in R2's input destination. Remember that the issue stage goes from R1 to R2. And so R2's input would be the results of issue. Similarly for execute, we actually have it both places. It's both coming out and going in. And for write, we have it just coming out. So we have all three of them are going to RAX, which means that issue wants to forward from the most recent one, execute. And so to get the value that is produced in execute, we need to go to the thing that execute is trying to put into the next value, hence R3's input. You could argue R2's output. That will only work assuming that the execute stage is doing nothing. And so we generally want to grab from R3's input instead of R2's output under the assumption that execute was modifying the result in some way. And then we had our pipelining. So I had the timings of various steps that could happen, the sequences of instructions that could exist, and your job was to find the optimal break. I should note, if all sequence of instructions could have existed, then we would have just been trying to find a way of slicing this list in a way that would minimize the differences. So something that both read and write, which none of these can do, we would have a different kind of answer. If something both write and write back, again, we'd have this different kind of answer. But because no single instruction did all of them, then for each of the cases, we need to figure out how long stage 1 needs and how long stage 2 needs. So let's just sort of walk through how I did this for A. Okay. For A, I said, okay, I have between fetch and decode. So I know that fetch takes up here 40 nanoseconds. And so it doesn't matter, all of these instructions have a fetch, so all of them need 40 nanoseconds for stage 1. For stage 2, they each need a different set depending on what instructions they're doing. So I need to find out what's the slowest of all of those. So I add up decode execute and B, the register writing. I add up the RMB, I add up the DERB, and I add up DW. And the slowest of those will be the time stage 2 needs, which turns out to be 105 nanoseconds. And then because it doesn't do any good for fetch to run faster than decode, because the information has nowhere to go, just as if I'm in an assembly line and one person works twice as fast as everybody else, they can't get the information quicker and they can't shove it on faster than the people on the other side of them. So I have to take the lower of those two, making my entire delay I need would be 105 nanoseconds plus whatever overhead the pipeline register gave. And using similar logic for all of the others, we can find that B is the best at 85 nanoseconds, C is hardly behind it at 90 nanoseconds, and the others are all up in the hundreds somewhere. So, all of that said, questions, comments, concerns, things about the quiz. Okay. I should also note, I mentioned last week that I was going to sort of review how people did on the exam and compare it to try to figure out what was going on and if I should make some sort of adjustment. And I have decided to make a small positive adjustment to those grades, probably equivalent to as if everybody had submitted a wrapper. I am in the process of entering that into the system. Most likely that will end up looking like just sort of an automatic, an extra item to tweak that in your progress site. Is the simplest way to make that happen. It does appear that I asked more hard questions and fewer easy questions than I usually do, and therefore that this score is not quite characterizing the understanding I wanted to measure. All right, where do we want to? So, we are talking about pipelines. Last class, as we were talking about pipelining, we went through in some detail how we would go about actually forwarding, showing out a three-stage pipeline and actually like wiring up a MUX in an illustration there and so forth. And we had spoken about stalling some before, how that could work, inserting some knobs. And so what I'm going to pick up with today is about speculative execution. My expectation, we will see if I'm right, is that we will finish with speculative execution about halfway through today's lecture and then start talking about out-of-order processors, because I don't have a lot to say about optimal pipeline depth beyond what we said last Friday. So let's talk about speculative execution. All right. Remember the basic idea we mentioned in advance that we could wait. We could find the result. If we had some sort of dependency, we could wait, we could find the result, or we could guess. Okay, and waiting results in stalling, finding the result, it results in forwarding, and we have sort of talked through how these could actually work, how we could use some comparators and muxes to decide when to do them. And guessing at some level is not much more complicated than finding the result, except we need to actually make a guess. So we're going to talk about several different kinds of guesses or speculation. Some principles that guide it, and then some common kinds that are in use, and a few principles about how those work. So speculation is going to be our primary topic for the first part of class today. No, not speculation, speculation. All right. The most important thing to know about speculation, we have this sort of hard requirement. We must not do anything we can't undo. So before we know if our guess is correct, we must restrict ourselves to things that can be undone. And there are some other models of this that could work, but the simplest version is we're not going to write either to the register file or to memory. Because those are things that, although we can undo them, we can write the old value, we'd have to keep the old value around to do it, and it would take significant time. These are generally going to be sort of the lines we won't cross as we are trying to do our speculation. And so if our speculation hasn't been resolved, if we don't know if we guessed right, by the time we would get to a stage that would do one of these things, we're going to have to start stalling. And we can easily do that, but this is going to be a limitation on what we can do. So there's going to be a few different things we're going to try to speculate about. We're going to start by talking about branches and other conditional instruction. Okay, we have a lot of conditional instructions, but branches in particular are going to be challenging because we're going to need to know them really early. We're going to know, in order to speculate, we're going to need to know whether we want to take a branch or not during issue or fetch, during that very first cycle, to know what the next instruction we're going to have to load is. There's going to be several different pieces of this. There's the do we jump problem, and then there is the where to problem. And we're going to solve these in very different ways. To figure out whether we jump or where we jump to, we'll have different kinds of designs. And we're going to start with do we jump, which is most commonly called branch prediction. Predicting which of two branches we go down in our program. And this could happen, for example, if we have a JLE to my favorite label in my code, not labela. I guess it doesn't matter if it's labela, but label. Okay, if I have this in my code, I know the two addresses that could exist, right? As this gets encoded down into an immediate, which is the address I might be jumping to, and I can add the size of the instruction to get the other address. So I know I have a branch. I know I'm going to go one of two ways. I know what both of the addresses are. When I am taking apart my instruction and parsing out that immediate and what the instruction is, I know the possible addresses. But what I don't know is which branch I'm going to take. And so I have this simple do I jump or not kind of thing that we need to predict. So let's start by just taking some very simple branch predictors. We could just guess we jump. Every single time we see a jump, we could assume we're going to jump, that we're never going to fall through. This would be a simple branch predictor, very easy to code. There's no extra logic to decide what's going on. We just begin jumping and reading those and fetching those instructions. And then if we find out we're wrong, we flush them out. And then we could ask ourselves what the benefit of this is. Okay? So if we think about our five-stage pipeline, let's go back to the one that we were talking about before and that we have in our write-up. We have our fetch, decode, execute, memory, write back. And let's assume, because there's lots of different cases we could do here and we need to worry about the condition codes existing, in general, if I have a jump instruction here, the compare instruction could have been right before it. And so it's not really until after the compare instruction finishes executing. So it's not till sort of the end of that stage that I'm going to know if something could work. So I'm going to have to allow my guess to run for two instructions. I'm going to have to fetch in an instruction. I I'm going to have my speculated instruction here. I'm going to have guessed what my instruction is going to be. It's going to be the target of my jump. My jump is running, my compare is running. So I have this situation where I can imagine possibly figuring out everything this early. We could also imagine that comparing the less than equal to the condition code flags could take an extra cycle. So maybe we'd have two speculated, but let's just assume we are missing one instruction if we guess wrong, okay? So if we guess wrong, then effectively a jump is two cycles, right? We guess what we need to do. We begin fetching that next thing. Then we realize we're wrong, okay? I guess actually let's make sure it's two cycles. Okay, so if at this moment I realize I am wrong, then at this moment I can tell this what it needs to go fetch. And so my next cycle, I'm going to have my comparison down here. My jump is going to be here. That did happen. This is going to have been knocked out. And then I'm going to have my fix here, my corrected one there. So my bad case is that my jump effectively was two cycles long, a jump followed by a knob. My good case is that I didn't have that, right? And so I've got plus one cycle per misprediction. So even if I guess wrong every single time, if I'm never correct, if we'd never take a jump, effectively I'm just adding a number of cycles equal to my number of jump operations for this pipeline. If I have more stages in my pipeline, this becomes more complicated. It is relatively common in, say, a 10-stage pipeline as we see today to have two or three fetch instructions followed by decode. So commonly execute starts somewhere around cycle four, five, or six. And so I might be missing three or four cycles. And the deeper my pipeline is, in general, the farther that goes. Because it turns out that many things the ALU does, it does quite quickly. It's this accessing memory and accessing the register file that can slow us down a little bit. So if I assume this is the case, if I'm never right, I have no extra cost. This is what I would have had if I stalled instead. And if I get it right sometimes, then I'm doing better than normal. So this is going to get me some savings. And if I assume this is random, I've effectively cut the length of a jump from 2 to 1.5. And so we can start with something very simple. We're just going to make a guess. There's no cost to making it wrong. There's no cost in time to making it wrong. There's only a cost to making, and there's a benefit to making it right. So even if I'm rarely right, I still benefit. But if we have this question, if I guess wrong every single time, would it consume more power or electricity than just stalling? So yes, it would require generally not much more. Because the clock is ticking along, we're going to be consuming quite a lot of energy just running along, and moving knobs through the pipeline is also going to take energy. So it's not a huge difference, but we are going to do more difference because these instructions are going to have more work to do, particularly the actual fetching of these instructions, going out to instruction memory and so on, will consume some extra power. So if we know we'll always get it wrong, we will boost our power bill compared to just not speculating, but not our timing. Or not our timing in any significant way. Extra logic to handle the speculation might also add a transistor or two to our clock cycle. All right. So we want to do better than just guessing always jumped. How can we find out what is better? Okay. So we could guess that every branch is taken. We could guess that every branch is not taken. Which one of these is better? Well, you can design code where either one is better. I can take code and swap the order of the fall through versus the target for almost all of the jumps in my code. And so I can tweak my code around to manipulate this. So what we really want to know is not what it means to be, but what is most likely to be. And so to pick between these, we're going to profile. That is, we're going to take some representative code that we believe represents what usually happens in the real world, and we'll instrument a chip or a simulator to figure out, are we jumping or not? Which one is more common? And we're gonna just pick the one that happens more in that profiled code and hope you write code like that code base. When we do this, we can quickly realize that there is an extra piece of information we can do. One of the things we have found is that forward jumps, okay, so if I have some sort of jump lossly equal and my label here is down here someplace, that's a forward jump. I'm jumping forward in the code. These are usually not taken. The way that compilers encode if statements means that they'll tend to have forward jumps. And the way humans write if statements, it turns out we tend to write a lot more check for bad, unlikely thing and do something special than check for expected case and do something special. And so we tend to have more of these if statement kind of jumps be uncommon in practice the way most people write code. But if we look at a backward jump, we find those usually are taken. Because backward jumps, typically, a backwards jump would have the label up here. And that would be a loop. Whereas this would be an if in general. Not all of them, but many of them. And most loops run several times. So I'm going to hit this backward jump multiple times for loop before it jumps, it fails to go. And so guessing taken tends to be good for a backwards jump. So with this observation, we can then try to make some special logic, right? Let's consider that PC register. Okay. I have taken my instruction out and I have found, here is its immediate value. That is going to be one of the possible destinations that I could put into this system. Okay. And the other one is going to take the old value of the PC and add something to it. Right. So we're going to add the instruction size to that. And that's going to be our other option. And we need to pick between these. And this is how we're building our taken, not taken kind of speculation. And so that selection, right? That selection that we want to do, let me do a little wire hop symbol there. So that speculation that we're going to do, we're just going to compare these two values. So we're going to take the immediate and the size, and we're going to throw them through a less than comparator and use that to do our comparison. A less than is not nearly as complicated as a subtraction, right? I'm just sort of looking for what's the first bit that's set in one and not in the other. And addresses are unsigned, so I don't even have to worry about two's complement or anything like that. I can just sort of skim through, find the first set bit, or the first bit at which they differ from the most significant bit. And if that bit is a 1 for the PC and a 0 for the immediate, then I'm going to say, that was a backward jump. And therefore, I'm going to take it. If it wasn't, I'm going to say it was a forward jump. So I can write this little special comparator to do this very efficiently and pick my next program counter accordingly. And so I can start making this fancier predictor. Once I start down this route, though, I can start asking, well, what else could I notice? What else might be an interesting piece of information, right? Maybe I would notice that if the jump was immediately preceded by a compare, it had different behavior than if the jump was immediately preceded by an add. Or maybe I would notice that this particular line of code jumps 3 times and then doesn't jump once. And so we might notice these sorts of patterns, these iterated patterns along the way. And so what we're going to do is we're going to make branch prediction state. We're going to have some kind of array of registers, a big set of registers that we're going to use to store information about how things are going and try to guess what is going on. And the most there's been a lot of innovation in design and branch prediction, okay? But in general, what many, the sort of the beginning of what they look like is we're going to take some part of the PC here as an index. Typically neither the lowest nor highest bit, some sort of near-ish the low to try to distinguish different jumps with as little work as we can. And then inside this, we're going to have what's called a shift register or circular buffer, various ways of doing it, which says, I took it and then I didn't take it, and then I took it and then I took it and then I took it. And it's going to sort of loop around. And then we're going to have some simple rule about so that every time I go into a new one, I'm going to slide all of these values down and stick in a new, I didn't take it, number is going to come in. And so we're going to have this sort of circular history of did we take a jump at this address or not. Some fancier things we can do, but this will get us a pretty long way. We pick the right distance here, pick the right heuristic based on the pattern we see about what we expect to do next. We can get our branch predictors for code generated by humans writing C in common styles and using a compiler up above 90% accurate. Okay, and so if I can get 90% accuracy, and let's suppose I have a 3-cycle penalty, so misprediction penalty, because let's suppose I had 3 stages that I guessed before I managed to resolve it. This would mean I would have 2 cases. 9% of the time I'd have a single cycle jump, 90% of the time, and 1% of the time I would have a 4-cycle jump. And then we could combine these to figure out what the total cost of this instruction is. And that would make a jump that has an average, each jump, assuming I get this 90% and this is my delay, I'm gonna have 0.9 plus 0.04, so plus 0.4, right? 0.9 plus 0.4 is going to be 1.3. So on average, this is assuming I'm going to have a 1.3 cycles per jump. Some of them will be 4-cycle jumps. Some of them will be 1-cycle jump. I'll never have a fractional cycle. But on average, I can get this down. And anything I can do to make this more accurate can make that get closer to 1. This is the basic concept of how we predict should we jump or not. Questions about this? What I have just described makes code more efficient, but also results in potential. This is a relatively easy side channel to fix, but does potentially result in a side channel. Pardon me. So, as we were talking about side channels earlier, remember, this is a means of communication that we didn't think of as a means of communication. How could this be? Right? So to understand how this could potentially be, we have this buffer. This buffer contains some information about how code ran. It contains some information about were branches taken or not, right? And so let's suppose I have some code that is doing some sort of checking if the password at some letter that you typed is equal to the password I expected at that same index, right? If I had some sort of loop that went over and compared your password character by character, and this was running in one piece of code, this was running that I wanted to eavesdrop on, and then my code happened to be scheduled right after that, I might be able to use the information stored in my branch prediction buffer to find out if particular characters of the password I typed were correct. Now, I can't access the branch prediction buffer directly, but I can figure out what its values are if I know how this number is being used to predict branches, and I can predict and can measure the timing of my own. So if I have, so this piece of code will set the branch prediction. The branch prediction buffer there is going to have some information set because of that. And then, so then if my sort of my attacker code, if my attacker code can use the same entry, so if I can get some my code to have an if statement that will line up with the same entry in the branch prediction buffer as the code I'm trying to measure, and I can time it repeatedly, at a high, close to cycle level result, the end result could be that I could tell how it ran, when it said yes and when it said no. This relies on a lot of ifs. Maybe I wasn't scheduled right after that. Maybe the operating system that came into control for a few cycles in between that code and my code messed up some of the branch prediction buffer. Maybe I got my timing not quite at the cycle level, so I'm guessing whether I got it exactly right, right? There's a lot of error here that are based on things outside of my control. But if I can try over and over and over again, I can make more and more confidence that I have figured out what is going on in your code. So this is an example of a whole family of attacks that have come out of timing-based attacks as our processors have become more and more sophisticated. As they're storing internal information to try to make things faster, we can see, was it faster, to tell what other processes were doing. Now, in this particular case, there's an easy fix to it. We can simply erase the branch prediction buffer when we switch processes. And it turns out to actually have performance benefit as well, because the branch prediction pattern of one piece of code and a different piece of code are not correlated in general. And so it's easy to fix this, is we're just going to erase. We're going to throw away that information that would be part of the side channel. We're going to erase on a context switch. So I am unaware of any current exploits that use this particular side channel. But the principle behind it of understanding enough about how the hardware works to find some piece of information that will influence the time of my code based on what your code did will be a process that shows up again and again and again and again in exploits involving processors in the past 15 years or so. And I see no reason to believe these kinds of attacks and vulnerabilities will stop. All right. This is what I wanted to say about the first kind of branching. Do we jump or not? Thoughts, comments, questions? Okay. That works great when we have something like call queue foo. Well, we always know we jump that. There's no special work to do. So this one is just done. If we have our jump less than or equal to foo, then we have good prediction. We know where we're going. Okay? But there are others that are going to be more complicated. For example, if I have jump less than or equal to star REX, for example, I hope I have the syntax here right. I have some idea there's an extra letter here that I'm forgetting. But anyway, if I have these things where my address is not a flat address, but is rather stored in a register, then I need to worry about some forwarding, right? I need some forwarding to solve this problem. But I can't forward as quickly as I want. Let's go back to our simple five-stage processor, which is already complicated enough to deal with our problem. Right? If this instruction is a jump less than or equal, and this instruction, let's say over here in memory, is going to be writing to RAX, so I'm loading an address from memory, then I'm not going to be able to know what goes here. And so it's not enough to say, yes, I am jumping. I could assume I'm not jumping. I could just say, well, all of these indirect jumps are not taken. But very often when we see these ones with a pointer, what we're actually seeing is an unconditional jump. We know we are jumping. We absolutely know the jump is going to occur. There is no guesswork in the jump occurring or not. The guesswork is in where is the jump occurring. Okay. And so if I don't know where the jump is occurring, even knowing that I've assumed there will be a jump, I don't know where to go. And so for this, we need to have a jump target predictor. We have to guess where we are going. Another case we need to do that is in any ret queue. Ret queue pops the return address off the stack. They say it reads from memory into the return address. And so we need to definitely be able to predict that jump target. Let's start with ret queue and then we'll get back to this other one to talk about some of the things that we're going to do to try to solve this. For the ret queue, we're going to have a fake stack. the simple idea of RetQ is I'm actually going to have a stack of registers that is just going to be my return addresses. And it's going to be a hardware stack. That didn't quite work. Okay, so I'm going to have this hardware implemented stack of return addresses. And this is not the real stack. I can't deal with the fact that real code could modify memory. Real code could jump and then return, push and then return. There's various things real code could do that this doesn't fully handle. But assuming that every call is mapped by a return and that it, and we're using the stack in sort of the standard C way, then we can get a pretty, we can know where we're going correctly most of the time. However, because this is going to be in hardware and going to be fast, it's going to be finite. And so if we call, let's just say we picked, what did I draw here? I drew 7. That's an odd number. I guess we could do 7. But let's suppose I had an 8-element stack. After, if I make 9 calls, then that 9th return, the value won't be on the stack because I will have overflowed. And so the general idea is when we pop back out, we put some sort of special either stall or we copy this last value into it, assuming that if we got 9 in, it's because we're in some sort of deep recursion. And let's assume we're going back to where we came from. And so we can use this understanding of the structure of how return in particular works to create this return stack. So that works great for the return instructions. But what about this more general, I am jumping to a value that will be read, maybe read from memory, maybe computed in the ALU, I don't know what it's going to be. And so for this one, we're not going to get very good, probably, but we might be able to essentially cache where we jumped the last time we had an indirect jump like this, right? So when I have this kind of indirect jump, that is to say a jump where my target is not an immediate value, we can just have a buffer of addresses. Under the assumption that when this occurred in your code, and a switch statement is one case where this shows up quite a bit, many implementations of object-oriented programming in order to chain polymorphism will do something like this, where they'll have sort of an array of function locations. Right? And so we can just have a buffer where we store recent addresses that have been used. We can do the same trick we did for branch prediction of using part of the PC to separate this out. But instead of having this long chain of information, we can take part of the PC into this buffer. And then here we just have an address. When you ran this line of code before, here's where you went. I'm going to assume you're going to do it again. We could add some more complexity to this, but this will again get us a long way there because code tends to run the same line over and over again. It tends to go the same place over and over again. Let's try to make this slightly more concrete. Let's imagine that I have some sort of object array in Java. Let's call it X. And I'm going to be looping over object y in x. I assume you have seen iterator loops like this at some point in your Java learning. If you haven't, let me know and we can talk about how that works. And so then inside here, let's suppose I were doing println y. Well, the println function is going to call toString. So under the hood, what it's going to do is call toString. And so that toString function is going to be overloaded. Different object types will have different places in memory where that code exists. So what this is really going to do under the hood is it's going to go to y's special vtable, as we learned about at the end of COA 1, this array of function addresses. And it's going to go into whatever index to string is in that function. Let's just assume that's arbitrarily a 2, I don't know. And it's going to jump to that location. Okay? So it's going to be doing a memory lookup for each of these objects. But it is likely that however you wrote your code, you ended up with a bunch of objects of the same type in this list. Maybe not. Maybe each of these is a different kind of object and each of them is going to call a different toString. And if that's the case, we're sort of out of luck. But assuming you have mostly the same type of value in this list, then just going to the same toString function we went to last time is likely to get us pretty good performance. And maybe your list is actually an integer, a string, an integer, a string, an integer, a string, something like that. So maybe storing some sort of iterated pattern, like we did for a branch predictor, and sort of shifting them as they go would give us something slightly better. Then you can imagine other kinds of complexities we could add here. But using these beginning steps, we can start storing more information about where we expect you to go. Where did you call? What did you jump here last time? Did you jump here last time? The more of that information we store, the more we can use that to make good speculation. The cost, of course, is added complexity of design. More transistors needed to do it, and because more transistors needed to do it, more physical chip space. There's always a trade-off between if I store way more information, my chip becomes too big and I have to slow down my clock to give time for information to flow. I have to use more power to store it all. And if I have too little, then I'll make bad predictions and end up losing cycles. And so modern chips, there's a significant work in making better predictors, different predictors that are not as well understood by other people, because we want to have an advantage, that are more complicated, so we'll get it right more often. And again, a lot of this based on profiling. We run a lot of code, try to figure out what are the patterns we see, and then can we make hardware that can anticipate those patterns? And this is the idea of prediction, speculation generally. Thoughts, comments, questions about speculation and prediction? Okay, this is pipelining. We start with the idea that by breaking tasks into different pieces, we can get higher utilization of the parts of our computer, like an assembly line. But we realize there are dependencies. We can detect those easily enough, but stalling is too bad. Forwarding helps some, add some extra muxes. Speculation gets us most of the rest of the way there. And so we can get these very efficient, high throughput processors for common uses. In the worst case, where we guess wrong every time and we have highly dependent code, this may be slower than a single cycle processor. But the worst case occurs so rarely, it takes this sort of pathological effort to try to create a worst case scenario. This almost always results in faster speeds in practice. But it isn't the end of the story. What we actually do is out-of-order processing. We don't have time to go into this in detail, but let's talk about what I mean by out-of-order processing in a human system, okay? So, a pipeline, we said, is like an assembly line. And there's a really important thing to understand about an assembly line, which is that it's a line, right? We have people and they are standing in one order. And information or parts or whatever it is flows between them in always one way. There's no skipping. There's no sort of checking out what's going on and so forth. But not all businesses use their large numbers of employees to create assembly lines. Okay. We also have the idea of multi-core. Right? And this is the idea that we each do it, okay? And so this is the idea that I do the full task myself and you do the full task yourself with a different problem. And so we have this multi-core, and many businesses are designed around this concept, right? Where we sort of spread out the work to different people to do entire tasks by themselves. But most systems don't really limit themselves to either of these. Many of them allow, I have different people that have different jobs, okay? So I might have, I don't know, the accountant, and I might have the illustrator, and I might have, I don't know, maybe I've got two people that I both call writers, and I might have somebody that is the coder, and I might have somebody that does design, and whatever the groups of people are, they all have tasks. And what happens is when a job comes in, right, I have some sort of job, we figure out what order things need to go. So we decide, okay, we have to decide how much money we need. We then need it to be designed and coded. And every new task that comes in might have a different process of what it might need. Maybe one of them, I'm going to need to have a writer work on it and then an illustrator work on it and then send it to the accountant. I don't know what exactly we need, but we might have different approaches, right, for different things that are coming in. And so we're going to have these ideas of these separate jobs. And so we're going to take this job, we're going to send it to the accountant because the accountant needs it first. And the accountant is then going to finish the job, is going to note that we have done the accounting, that is done, is now ready for design and then coding. And oh, by the way, I have attached to it the money you need, okay? And so then this can go over to the designer. The designer can do that, can say, ah, all right, great, I've used that. I've done the design now. I've attached to it the design document that you needed to know what was going on to send it on to the coder. Maybe there's still some money attached. And then we can send it to the coder. And so each task can flow through all of these employees in a different pattern. And we can have them go in whatever order they want. And so a lot of businesses try to design systems in some version of this way, try to organize their employees in this very sort of open system. Problems with this, lots of problems with this. The main problem we have is management. We have a strong need to decide how jobs get to flow between things, to decide what the priority of different jobs are. If several are waiting for you, do I take the one that has the most other people it needs to visit or the one that's oldest? How do I decide what the right priority is? We start having issues with needing to have the employee balance. When I have an assembly line, I know exactly how many people of every specialization I need. I need one for every station in my assembly line. In the sort of multi-core model, I don't have to worry about that at all because they're all identical. And so if I need more people, I just hire another person. But when I have specialization without any kind of line, now I might realize that the illustrator always has a big queue and my writers are often idle or whatever it is. And so I might need to have this more complicated system of balancing out employees, right? And I also have communication. Where do these jobs go? What do I mean by saying a job now has the accountant checked off and money attached to it? How do I transmit this information? And so a lot of this management and priority and balancing and communication and so on are things we're going to want in our processor. In our processor, we're going to have things like the thing that can read from memory and the thing that can understand an instruction. But we're also going to have things like an adder and a multiplier and the thing that can write to memory and so forth. We're going to have these different things that we commonly call functional units. And we're going to try to put them together in such a way that there's an understandable management. Tasks can flow through them however they want. They don't need to run in order. they can happen in a different order. Whoever's ready to work on them can start working on them. And then we're going to have to deal with all of these other issues. So we'll dive into how this works on Wednesday. On our schedule, it currently says we will do that on Friday. We will swap Friday and Wednesday's conversation. I will see you all on Wednesday.